I chose two lessons for the service, one from the Hebrew Bible and another from the Gospels. And I have a very special colleague here tonight who has become in recent years a rather dear friend, who pastors the St. Luke African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church here in Grand Rapids, and who, whenever I come this way, has been most attentive to this old person. And I'm inviting him to read the gospel lesson after I have read to you from the Hebrew Bible. The lesson from the Hebrew Bible is from Exodus, the book of Exodus, chapter 13, reading from verse 17 to the end of that chapter. Let us hear the word of the Lord. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. After leaving Succoth, they encamped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way. And by night, in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. The word of God for the people of God.
The New Testament reading from Matthew 28th chapter, verses 16 through 20. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely, I will be with you always, to the very end of the age. May the Lord bless the reading and the hearing of his most awesome and powerful word.
The Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them along the way. and in a pillar of fire by night, to give them light so that they might travel by day and by night. I'm sure all of you here know that the most momentous event in Israel's history is the Exodus from Egypt. You read the Hebrew Bible, and you can't help the numerous places in which the Exodus from Egypt is either mentioned or allusions made to it. It comes up repeatedly, repeatedly, repeatedly. Because that's perhaps the event that marked the beginning of Israel as a people. That is not in any way downplaying the theophanies to Abraham and to Isaac and Jacob and all the other stories we read of the patriarchs. But Israel as a people, Israel as a nation, emerged from the time of the Exodus from Egypt. Central to the Exodus story is the man Moses, an interesting character, very fascinating. And it's interesting how the narrator of the book of Exodus takes time to tell us lots about this central figure in this story. Tells us about his birth and his sort of miraculous upbringing. How he was miraculously saved by his mother placing him in a basket on the river. And he was rescued by Pharaoh's daughter, brought up in Pharaoh's palace as Pharaoh's grandson. A child of a slave, brought up as a prince. But the story is even more intriguing than that, because it so happened that the nursemaid who looked after him in Pharaoh's household was none other than his own mother. The only difference is Pharaoh's daughter didn't know it. But somewhere along the line, as they brought him up, oh, they must have whispered in his ears who he is. Because when he became a young man, strong, strong, you remember how he saw an Egyptian mistreating one of his own people? And how, in a fit of rage, he interceded on behalf of his own fellow, I want to say Israelite, but that's even so early to call them Israelites, but his own fellow Hebrew. And in so doing, he managed to kill the Egyptian and had to run for his life. Took off to a place called Midian. And in Midian, he met the priest of Midian, a man named Jethro, who had some beautiful daughters. Life is strange, isn't it? It got even stranger than that. Because it's while he was in Midian, he had his own theophany. One day, looking after his father-in-law's flock, on the distant mountains, he saw smoke and fire. And he drew near to see what it was all about, only to have this rather strange encounter with Yahweh. Moses, Moses, take your shoes off your feet. The ground on which you stand is holy ground. When a burning bush begins to speak, I don't know about you. You know how the story goes, don't you? Here was Moses running for his life, having slain an Egyptian, goes away to Midian, safe in Midian. And guess what God says? Moses, go back to Egypt and tell Pharaoh, let these people go. And boy, I love the story in Exodus in which Moses argues with God. God, you don't quite know what you're doing. I don't know. You folk never ever debate God, but I have. God, me? The one thing he didn't have enough courage to say, I'm running for my life, and you're sending me back to the very people from whom I'm running. He made every possible excuse. And every excuse he made, God had an answer. I've learned that a long time ago. You can't out-argue God. Eventually, dear Moses had to go to say to Pharaoh, Pharaoh, God sends me to tell you to let his people go. Well, you know how Pharaoh was too. This is economic we're talking about. This is free labor we're talking about. You have a bunch of slaves working for you, building your empire, and somebody's coming, some upstart is coming to say, let them go, not understanding the whole economic undergirding of this country. This is big economics you're talking about. Oh, I forget I'm talking in America. And God had to do some things in Egypt that I think must have grieved the heart of God. You know, that's how the Passover started. The most moving plague that God had to do to move Pharaoh's heart was to kill all the firstborns in Egypt. You remember that? You remember that story? So Pharaoh relented and decided to let the people go. So here now, the people gathered all their belongings, everything they had, old women, young women, children, old men, young men, everybody on their way out of Egypt. This company of folk journeying out of Egypt. And after they've gotten some distance and Pharaoh begin to realize what a disaster it is for his economy, he did what many pharaohs would do. Gather the army and said to the army, bring them back. They took out of your Bibles that he said, bring them back dead or alive. I'm sure he wanted them more alive than dead. So the Egyptian army pursued them, took off, and started pursuing them. They were walking, the Egyptian army, well equipped with spears and swords and swords and chariots. And here these children of Jacob journeying on foot with their animals, with their belongings. And along the way, God recognizes that God had to do something for them. So God placed a cloud in the sky at daytime. And at nighttime, God placed a fiery cloud in the sky to give them light. Well, they journeyed till they got to what the Bible calls the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds. And this is where the story comes interesting for me. They get to the Sea of Reeds, and they hadn't built the bridge yet to cross over. See, they got there, and behind them were the armies of Pharaoh. And they panicked. They panicked. You know, one of the things in the whole Exodus story is that God really never left the children of Israel, but was always with them, sometimes to protect them, sometimes to guide them, sometimes to correct them, sometimes to judge and chastise them, but always there. They were never alone. And there's something in this story for all of us, I think. Three little things I want to say. The first is this. Whenever God sends us forth to do anything and to go any place, God journeys before us. He precedes us. He makes the way clear. Oh, how well I know this. You'll pardon me for being a little bit autobiographical. In 1994, I was the senior pastor of the leading United Methodist Church in the Northern New Jersey Conference of our church, a large congregation, about 1,200 members or so, very nice congregation. All the pastors in the conference aspire to be able to pastor that church. I was at Drew University as associate dean for 12 years before the bishop just called me and said to me, I need a pastor for this church. Would you be willing to go? And I said to him, as I've always said, at the point of my ordination, I said, send me where you want to send me. Use me however you want to use me. Said, if that's what you want me to do, I'll leave Drew, I'll leave the deanship, I'll go. So I went. And I was there minding my business when I had two offers to come back into theological education. One from the Divinity School at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. The dean called me up, said, I have an associate deanship position. I really want you to come. They interviewed me, and they said, now we need to work out your package. And no sooner I went back to New Jersey, I had a call from North Carolina saying, you know, we have a little seminary down here. It's not yet accredited. And we want a dean, and we heard about you. Will you please come and look at it? And I said to God, God, it's not my choice. It's yours. This little seminary in North Carolina did not have 30 students, was not accredited, was attached to a liberal arts college that had its own problem for finances and administration. Yale is a big school, well known. I could travel with a card in my pocket. Anybody said where you worked, pull out my card, you see, associate dean of the Divinity School at Yale, big shot, big deal. I still don't know how it happened. But God has some strange ways in working. I ended up, believe it or not, in North Carolina. My younger brother was completely beside himself. He thought I'd gone berserk. Some folk who knew me thought, well, I always know you to be kooky. Now I know you to be completely kooky, because nobody makes that kind of choice. So there am I. I go to Hood in 94. I remember the first day I walked up the steps. I looked back around and I said, this can't be for real. What on earth are you doing here? And as if someone out of the blue just started laughing at me and said to me, you just wait. 94 by 98, we were fully accredited in the Association of Theological Schools. By 99, I knew that we could no longer be held in the building where we were. The building was erected to accommodate 50 to 60 students at a maximum, and we had already gone to about 80, 90 students. This year, we moved to a vast new campus where we have approximately 300 students and still growing. And you know what is a testimony to how God works? I'll tell you. We are perhaps the most racially balanced theological school in the entire United States and Canada. Of the approximately 300 students we have, 55%, we are historically black seminary, 55% of the student body is African American, 45% is Caucasian. And you know what the students tell us why they come to Hood? They choose Hood as their first choice? Because of the quality of our education. Because of our seriousness about Christian ministry. And thirdly, because here in this institution, the racial differences are totally irrelevant. It's more than time in this country for that to be a reality. God has a way. When God calls us to do something, God goes before us to make the way clear. When folks say to me, look what you've done, I stop them and dead in the tracks and say, who, me? It's not me. And friends, it's really not me. It's God. When God calls you to go someplace and to do something, God has gone ahead of you to make the way clear. I wish I had time to tell you lots of stories about my experiences of God's providence. God's prevenient grace. The second thing I want to say to you briefly, quickly, is that when God sends us forth to do something, God journeys beside us. He journeys before us to make the way clear, but he journeys beside of us. He is our constant companion. We're never alone. Never alone. He's always there. He's always there with us. That's what the pillar of cloud meant to the children of Israel. God is there with you every day. And the pillar of fire meant God is there with you every night. And the more I thought about it, I thought, well, you know, that pillar of cloud must have been mightily important because these people are journeying through a desert. You know what is a desert? There's no water. And they didn't have bottles of water like we have. They left the bottles of water back in Egypt. But I could imagine along the way there are times when the clouds will break and the blessings of God would fall from the skies. You know what I'm talking about? The pillar of fire by night. You know, deserts are a very interesting place. They're scorching hot in the day, but they can cool off at night. And these people didn't bring their heaters with them. And that pillar of fire by night, not only did it give them light, it gave them warmth. God was concerned, very intimately concerned about their welfare and their comfort along the way. God made provision for them. Oh, there were times they didn't have food. You know the story, don't you? Let me tell you, this was not an easy bunch of people to lead, you know. You read the story in Exodus and you just shake your head and say, thank God I'm not God. Because every time these people encountered some hardship, they were ready to mutiny and to turn, send us, you brought us in the desert to kill us. We might have well stayed in Egypt and served Egyptians as slaves. We told you, leave us in Egypt, but you brought us out here to kill us. Are there not enough graves in Egypt? All this sort of stuff. And I read this and I say, God, I'm glad you're not me, or I'm not you. So they didn't have food. And they cried to God, we're starving for hunger. Moses, what you doing? And God said, all right, tell them, just look and see what I'm going to do. And guess what? God sent them something called manna. And they had plenty to eat. You think that sufficed them? Oh, after a few days of the manna, they said, Moses, we're tired eating the manna. We want meat. There must have been some of us African Americans among the group. We want meat. Oh, it's in the Bible. What I'm telling you is in the Bible. And God sent them quail. The other night, a couple of years ago, I was in Pittsburgh at a meeting. They took us to a fancy restaurant. And for appetizers, we had quail. I thought I was journeying through the wilderness. You know, God never ever leaves us when God sends us out. You don't hear me. God goes before us. God goes beside us. I know pastors that some of us sometimes, thank God it's not so in the Reformed Church, but sometimes we go to some congregations and believe you me, we think God sends us there and then God has taken off too. God, you brought us here, but you abandoned us. Have you forgotten the address? God never leaves us alone. Never, ever. And the last thing. By the way, there's a final thing too. But the third thing I want to tell you. You know, you people are funnier than I thought. That when God sends us forth, goes before us, precedes us, he goes with us, beside us, and he follows behind us to watch our backs. You know what it is to watch your back, to have your back watched? A few years ago, the Board of Trustees of Livingstone College invited me to be the president of Livingstone College because they had to dismiss the president rather unexpectedly, and they needed someone to take over the college because the college was going down the path of financial deficit year after year after year, and I don't know why it's me they turned to. So when I went to the college and I looked at the first thing you do is to look at the finances of the college, I realized this college was in really serious financial problem. So serious that for the first 5 months, I decided I'm not taking $1 salary from this college because the college can't afford to pay me. But I'll work. And boy, did I ever have to work, because I was determined in the 5 months I had before the end of the fiscal year to pull this college out of its hole. And to do so meant you had to curtail expenditure. You know what I mean, don't you? You have to raise funds. And the heaviest expenditure in any educational institution like that is something called salaries. And I had the real challenge of having to terminate the employment of several people. Call them into the office one by one. I told them the serious financial state of the college. And then I had to say to them, we can't afford to keep you. After I terminated that lot, those that I was going to keep, I had to call them in. I said to each one of them, you're earning this amount of money. I want you to volunteer to take a cut in salary. You tell me how much you're willing to take. I had already worked out how much I wanted each of them to take. And some of them came in, they were more generous with their cuts. I said, all right, you don't have to cut so deep. Cut up to here. And some who came in who were just barely scratching the surface, I said, you know, this ain't good enough. I want you to cut this deep. And you know, I was able to say to each one of them, let me tell you, I am not taking $1 salary. So when I asked you to cut, I'm not joking. If we're going to save this institution, we all of us got to be in it. I remember when I told my wife that, the one advice my wife gave to me, she said to me, if you have to do that, you better watch your back. You know what that means, don't you? You know what that means? So I called in my chief of security. You know, there are a few things in life that really worry me. I'm not a person who's scared of anything. But I took her advice. I called in my chief of security and I said to him, look, my wife says I have to watch my back. Do you think you can help me watch it? He said, oh, yes, oh, chief. Yes, oh, chief. And so when I'd walk around on the campus from time to time, going from one place to the other place, he was always a couple of steps behind me, watching my back. But it wasn't he who was really watching my back. You don't understand it, do you? It was God. It was God. Sometimes God sends us into places that are extremely difficult. But God doesn't abandon us. God watches our back. Never alone. Here are the children of Israel journeying in the Exodus from Egypt. And they had to learn that God went before them already. The places where they were going, God had already been. God was beside them. Every experience that they encountered, God encountered it with them. Remember when the army of Pharaoh was closing in on them, what God did with the cloud? Later on in the text, it tells us. God moved the cloud from in front of them and placed the cloud behind of them so that the Egyptian army could not see them. God journeys behind of us. Now, let me tell you something very interesting. The story of the Exodus, as we read it in the Bible, was not written at the time when these events were taking place. The story was written long after the events had taken place. The stories were written out of the tradition and memories of the people passed down for a few generations. I want you to hear me clearly on this. Because sometimes people are apt to think, even some preachers are apt to think, oh, these stories are too real. God doesn't do this. But let me tell you what's going on here. This story was written some generations after the events of which they describe, but they were written for a people in a later time. They were written for a people who were going through hell. Tell me if you understand what I mean. They were written for Israel at a later time in Israel's history when Israel was experiencing real trials and real hardships. And the writer was saying to them, remember? Tell me if you're still with me now. Remember? Remember? Remember the Exodus? That God was utterly faithful. God never left his people alone. Remember? So here you are now going through your own hell. Don't despair. Because you're never alone. And it is in that sense that this passage is relevant to us. I don't know through what you're going or through what you went, but sometimes our Red Sea and our Pharaoh's army behind may be a health issue. Sometimes it's a personal crisis in our lives. Sometimes it's a challenge we're faced in the places where we are located in ministry. Sometimes it's on the job. Sometimes it's in the community. And the text is saying, remember? Remember? God never leaves us alone. God goes before us. God goes beside us. God goes behind of us. And you know, this is part of the memory of the early church. You see, when the Gospel of Matthew was written, maybe some 50, 60 years after the resurrection, the writer of that gospel understood something that the church today needs to understand. That even as we are gathered together in his name here in this auditorium, guess what? The risen Christ is right here with us. You don't hear me. We're never alone. We're never alone. That's how you have to understand the text from the New Testament. Not so much the Jesus of history and his resurrection appearance going onto the mountain and calling the 12 and saying to them this great commission, but you have to understand this comes out of the conviction of a generation of Christians after that first Easter. their conviction is that the God who rose from the dead and appeared to the first disciples is still alive today and still visiting his people today and still saying to us today, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. You are not alone. You are never alone, because wherever God sends you, God has already gone ahead of you, and God is journeying beside of you, and God follows behind of you always. Amen.